There are analogies in this life that we look to because of what they portray, the rigors sometimes of the Christian life. It looks to us as an endeavor that we walk through and challenges that we face. And because I've had the opportunity on occasion to do a little bit of climbing, and I guess I tend to go back sometimes into the mountains in my mind when I look at some of the analogies that are there. And I want to share something along that line with you today. Some of the stories of the high-altitude mountaineering are pretty tough. It's risk and challenge, injury, and quite frankly, it's death. I was looking at some of the rates. They call it the death rate on some of the climbs of the major mountains in the world. The death rate on Mount Everest is 10%. 10%, the way they count that is for every 10 people who get to the top, there's one life lost in the process. The death rate on K2, which is, Everest would be K1, this is K2, death rate on K2 is 27%. More than one out of four die. Again, four people get to the top, and it costs a life and a little more. The death rate on Annapurna is 41%. These are the tallest peaks, what they call the 8,000-meter peaks. Two out of five. For every five people who get to the top, there are two who die in the process of trying. There's a climber that is known here in America, Ed Beesters, who recently wrote a book. He lives in Seattle. He's climbed all the 8,000-meter peaks. There's 14 of them. And he climbed them without oxygen. Now, I could get up here and I could talk about people who've lost fingers and toes of their lives or their friends or their partners. They've had frostbite and injury and deprivation. And that's the whole genre of mountaineering books to a large degree. Ed Beesters is different because he did something that was incredibly challenging in a different way. His book, No Shortcuts to the Top, I'd like to illustrate for you, again, what his approach was. And I think it bears a little witness on what our attitude and approach ought to be in our own Christian lives. He says, perhaps the single aspect of Endeavor 8000, that means he wanted to climb all the 8,000-meter peaks in the world, all 14 of them, without oxygen. It took him years. I think it took him 18 years, longer than most of those who have set that as a goal and then accomplished it. But there was a reason for that. He says, the single aspect of Endeavor 8000 I'm proudest of is I did it safely and I did it prudently. On 30 expeditions to 8,000-meter peaks, I never once got frostbite. You could get frostbite in the back of this room when they come into that door. It says, I never was seriously injured. On the 8,000ers, they call them that. It sounds strange to me, but that's what they use. I've gotten closer to exhaustion than any other time in my life, but I've never suffered, he says, thank God, from either pulmonary, lung, cerebral, and brain, edema. And even from a bad case of acute mountain sickness. I've never had to be rescued. I've helped plenty of other climbers down those mountains, but I've never had to be helped down myself. Most importantly, I've never lost a partner. He did something that was incredibly challenging, but he did it in a particular way that allowed him to proceed in a responsible manner. Among my 30 expeditions, I've reached the summits of the 8,000ers an even 20 times. That means I had to, or decided it was only safe to, turn back 10 times. So 30 expeditions, 10 of those 30, he turned back in the course of the climb. Four times he turned back on Everest, twice on Annapurna, once east on Shishapangma, Broad Peak, Dalagiri, and Nanga Parbat. Now, those names don't mean much unless you read those books. But what's important? On Shishapangma, he turned back within 20 vertical feet of the top. You understand, we're talking a climb that takes a year to prepare. It takes tens of thousands of dollars to pay for the permits and to get yourself up the mountain. And within 100 yards of the top, he would stop and look and said, the conditions are not right. I will go no further. I am not going to risk my life for this endeavor. It's incredible to say he has done that on at least two different peaks, where he is 100 yards from the summit, and in some cases only literally a few feet vertically, and because of the conditions and the circumstances or the weather, he stopped and he said, I will go no further. And he went back. He accomplished that task without the loss of a finger or a toe or a partner or by disability in any way. He said, four out of those 10 turnarounds came when I was within 350 vertical feet of the top. I am proud of the fact that I never turned around because of lack of preparation, strength, or desire. It was not personal failure because he did not have the will and because he had not prepared for the task. He says, it was always the conditions that caused me to pause and retreat. There are things in this life when we should be able to say, I will go no further. This is a risk to me spiritually. He did that physically, but he knew when to turn back. He has a motto. His motto is, getting to the top is optional. Getting down is mandatory. He lives by that motto. One of his biggest regrets is when he was climbing K2, one of his early climbs. It had been a very difficult climb. The weather had been tough. The circumstances had been difficult. He was moving up from one camp to another to assist another climber coming down who needed to be assisted off the mountain. And they got caught in a little bit of an avalanche. Some of the spindrift coming down was larger and larger until he began to feel that they were at risk, but they were trying to help another climber off the mountain. And he stopped and he dug a hole in front of him when his partner stopped to rest, and so that he could dive into it if an avalanche came down. And he looked up and he saw his partner disappear in a cloud of white, and the snow was on its way. He dove into his little hole, he threw in his ice axe, and he held, and he says the snow just kind of, everything went quiet and silent as the snow poured over the back of him as he dug in there and holding on. And he knew that his partner now was being swept down with the snow, and that there were moments would come. His partner weighed about 235 pounds, and he weighed 165, and the snow was sweeping his partner along, and he held on to that axe until the jerk came, and it pulled him out of the hole above a stretch where there was 8,000 feet drop off of that mountain. And he describes how he scrambled and tried to yell into his partner and trying to stick that ice axe back into that slope to where he could arrest them and stop. His partner never did get purchased, but he was able to get that axe in, and eventually there was another tug on the rope and the axe held. They continued. They went back and got the person down into camp and on. And so he tells this story of the riggers. He tells the story of going out on the final day to the summit and saying, I should not do this. The weather is not right. And they continued a little further and a little further. He finished the climb, made it to the top, and he risked his life getting back to his tent. In his book, he said, nothing will ever convince me that pushing on to the summit of K2 back in 1992 on that early climb had been anything other than a mistake. Most climbers consider success having reached the top at any price. And he said it was a huge mistake. He says, I regarded as the biggest mistake of my climbing career. What I learned from that episode has stayed with me for good. The lesson was, some things are optional. Some things are mandatory. Getting to the top is a physical endeavor. Putting God first is mandatory. Our college, our schooling, the opportunities, our jobs, even many of our friendships are optional. Seeking first the kingdom of God is mandatory. It is an endeavor, but it is an endeavor that we have to be willing to put first. I thought it was dramatic, again, to look at a climber that said, I am doing this, but I'm going home when I'm done. And I'm not going to let anything stop me from going back to do what I'm really here for. I like the mountains, but my home is down there. That's where I live. That's where I want to return. We need to differentiate between what is optional, our physical pursuits, and what is mandatory, building godly character, putting God first. And we never want to confuse the two. There are some things we do because we want to do them. But we must always recognize what it is we must do because we must. Because it is important. And nothing can compromise or be compromised in that way. In the book of Hosea, chapter 6, verse number 4, Ephraim and Judah, Israel, are described here as having a very strong weakness in character, and the firmness of conviction just simply doesn't exist. It says, O Ephraim, what shall I do to you? O Judah, what shall I do to you? God speaking, you know, you have rebelled against me. You have turned away from me. You have sought out your own devices. What will I do to you? Your faithfulness is like a morning cloud. Like the early dew, it goes away. He said, there's a pretense. There's a presence of, well, we want to obey, but there's no conviction. There's no absolute choice that is made. It is a shame, brethren, if we called of God, given the power of His Spirit, given the opportunity of His blessing, the protection as He put angels around us, if we do not then take and direct our thoughts and our efforts to serve Him in that way and to put Him first. In the book of Proverbs 25, it talks about ruling over our spirit. Proverbs 25 and verse number 28. Whoever has no rule over his own spirit is like a city broken down without walls. You know, the walls are there to protect that city. And it just says, if you have no ability, if you don't have the will, if you can't look and say, I will go no further, it is dangerous. This will cost me spiritually. I will not do that. I will not go there. Then it says it's like a city that is supposed to be defended, but the walls have just been destroyed. There is no protection. The Bible talks about what it's like. It describes those people who are convicted and committed and willing truly to put God first in the book of Psalms, Psalms 15. It says, the character of those who may dwell with the Lord. The people who will say, no, I will go no further in that way. That would hurt me. That would keep me from doing what is mandatory. The optional activities are not worth it. But Psalm 15. Lord, who may abide in your tabernacle? Who may dwell on your holy hill? Who's going to be part of the body and who is going to be in the kingdom serving at your side? He who walks uprightly, works righteousness, speaks the truth in his heart, who does not backbite with his tongue, nor does evil to his neighbor, nor does he take up reproach against a friend, in whose eyes a vile person is despised, but he honors those who fear the Lord. He who swears to his own hurt and does not change. My word is my bond, it says, but that's in putting God first. To actually not be willing to break your commitment in a right and proper way. He who does not put out his money at usury, nor does he take a bribe against the innocent. We had our Bible study this morning, and what I was discussing and presenting was the fact that there have been people at times that have been left behind in the mountains. They have not been rescued. And the concept of leaving each other behind is related to that. It is so important, brethren, that we care for each other, that we intercede for each other, that we remind each other that this is what we're doing, this is what's mandatory. Those things are optional. If need be, in a loving way, in a gentle way, that we confront each other about those things where we have begun to turn aside and turn away. It's an act of kindness and brotherliness. But the fact that we would give our lives to assist God in this way. I had an article I pulled. It had to do with a recent individual who was left up on Mount Everest and the type of individual who gave up all that he had in that endeavor to save him. You know, as it says here, who would swear to his own hurt and not change, would actually give his word, and even if it costs you, you would be honorable to carry through. A man from Olympia says, just days after a British climber was left to die near Mount Everest summit, an American guide abandoned his second bid to stand on top of the world so that he could rescue a mountaineer mistakenly given up for dead. Not only did Daniel Mazur not scale the world's highest peak from the northern side, he also failed to get his two paying clients to the top. It takes a year to prepare. It takes tens of thousands of dollars to buy a ticket and the permits and the guides and the service to be able to get to the top. It takes all of your effort. Most people in this life, including myself, will never go there. Many of those who do get one chance. It is their one chance. But you know what? Getting to the top is optional. Getting down is mandatory. We live down here. God's work is down here. He says, I was very disappointed to miss my chance at the summit. But even more that, I could not get my job done, Mazur of Olympia said upon returning to Nepal's capital, Kathmandu, on Thursday. Mazur, his two clients, and a Sherpa guide were just 2 hours away from the 29,000 30-foot peak on the morning of May 26, when they came across 50-year-old Lincoln Hall. He was left a day earlier when his own guides believed that he was dead. I was shocked to see a guy without gloves, you know, we're up here almost to the top, without gloves, hat, oxygen bottle, or sleeping bag at sunrise at 28,200 feet. Just sitting up there, said Mazur, who scaled Everest once before on the south side in 91. Mazur said Hall's first words to him were, I imagine you're surprised to see me here. Imagine that, 28,000 feet. Well, got lost on going to the store. He says Mazur said he knew Hall was okay because he wasn't crying for help and he still had a sense of humor. Mazur's team spent the next 4 hours pulling Hall away from the slopes, giving him bottled oxygen, food, and liquids. They radioed the base camp to tell Hall's surprised team that he was still alive. And while Mazur's team was busy assisting Hall, two Italian climbers walked past together toward the summit. I think something like 30 people walked by toward the summit. Getting to the top is optional. Getting back down is mandatory. When asked to help, they claimed they didn't understand English. On his return to base camp, Mazur discovered that indeed they did. I don't know why they didn't want to stop and help, he said. I hope when I'm there in that state and someone passes by me, I hope it's somebody like me. I hope that when I'm in need, somebody will help me. I'm willing to help them. This is a congregation. This is a family. We're not in here one by one by one by one. Ultimately, we're here together, called of God, serving God, trying to do His will. I hope when I'm there in that state, someone passes me. I hope it's somebody like me that will help. Hall's rescue came just days after David Sharp, 34, died May 15th, about 1,000 feet into his descent from the summit. Dozens of people walked right past him, unwilling to risk their own ascent. By the time some Sherpas showed up to help get Hall back to base camp, Mazur, his clients, and his own Sherpa were too exhausted now to attempt the peak. They had no choice but to return without completing their climb. But what did he do? He did what he had to. He did what he must. That's what Ed Beesters constantly would do. He would pull person after person off the mountain, sometimes getting up his climb, saying, I'll have to come back and finish this another day. But he never compromised his own values and his belief. He did what he knew in his heart was right. He says, we all looked at the summit and then returned. We all agreed there was no choice. Mazur has no regrets. Oh, yeah, it was worth it, he said. You can always go back to the summit, but you only have one life to live. If we had left that man to die, what would have always been on my mind? He said, that would have always been on my mind. How could you live with yourself having done that? It's interesting. When I lived in Pasadena, that's where Michelle and I were married, and I used to work for the church fleet department at that time. And I bought the cars for the men in the field and ordered some through companies that sell those through the factory, and I bought some from the dealerships themselves. But one time I called down to the dealership in Pasadena. I needed a particular car. They had it on the lot, and I asked the guy, can we buy it? We made an agreement, and I said, fine. We'll come down, we'll get the paperwork ready, and I'll come down to pick it up. I went down to pick it up, and the car was gone. You see, I'm a fleet buyer, and so I offered him a fleet price. And he hadn't a buyer for the car, so he sold it to me because at least it was some money, some gain. But in the meantime, somebody walked in and said, I want that one, and I will give you more. And he literally sold the other person the car out from under us. And he admitted that that's what he had done, and I said, how can you do that? He said, it's been hard. It's been hard. The economy has been kind of tough. Of course, I was very gentle and forgiving. I hope I've grown a little. But I just said, how do you go home at night and look at yourself in the mirror? That's what I said. How can you go home and look in the mirror? He who swears to his own hurt does not change. Who doesn't take advantage? The character of those who may dwell with the Lord, those that will be on his holy hill, those that will abide in his tabernacle. They're people in the service to God who understand what's optional, our physical goals and desires, and what is mandatory. The kingdom of God, holy, righteous character, putting God first. Tiny Jackson lost his son. I think it was Wednesday, and that's why Tanya's not with us today. I think we have an announcement on that for today for announcement services. And died from doing battle and cancer, and she was on her way down there if the memorial service was going to be held. But I got to go over and see her, and she has a poem in her dining room. And a number of you in this room have been in her house, eating dinner at her table, and the day when he was there as well. And I just thought it was important. It said in part, this day is important. I have exchanged a day of my life for it. When tomorrow comes, today will be gone forever. I hope I will not regret the price I paid. We have paid for today with this opportunity that God has given us. When you're called of God, and you respond to him, and when you serve him, that means you will seek the kingdom first. You will seek to put God first. There are things that are optional. We want those things. But we always have to remember what is mandatory. We can never afford to let the optional choices box out or push aside those things that are truly important. We are the people of God, and we must put God first.